It's time for us to get love right, folks. And so we invite you to check out the King and Queen of Hearts.
This is an incredible training for couples who are struggling in unsatisfying sex lives.
It's also for lifelong learners, people whose relationship is great and they want to make it even better.
In this three-part training that is filled with 8 different tutorials like the art of tantric kissing, eye gazing that is deep and intimate, connective and not creepy, and sacred sexual meditations, you do them with your lover to juice you up before sex. Communication tips and really, really valuable relationship essentials are all found in this training.
You know, a common mistake couples make is they wait, they put it off, they avoid, they resist. And if you want to continue doing that, well, good luck. But if you really want to make a change, get this today. Don't let another month go by where you're losing precious connection with your partner.
Plus, you can't beat the price on this program. One of our clients, Casey, said a spark in their intimacy is back on track.
Now, Sarah and her husband, you know what she told us, Willow? She said, finally, he learned how to kiss her right.
Oh my God, hallelujah. So happy for Sarah.
So if you want some radical changes in your love life, go to sexreimagined.com, click on courses, and scroll until you find the King and Queen of Hearts. And because you are a fan of the podcast, you can use the King and Queen 10 code in order to get 10% off. That is King and Queen 10. And you can use it in the checkout.
We are here with Sherry Winston, the author of The Women's Anatomy of Arousal. Leah and I are both longtime fans of this woman and her work. Sherry is a holistic sexuality teacher, founder of the Intimate Arts Center, and an award-winning author. One of her most well-known books is The Women's Anatomy of Arousal. So if you have not read this book yet, you must put it at the top of your book list. She's got it on audio. She's got it translated into Spanish and German. There's a hard copy. There's a soft copy. There's all kinds of copies you can play with. She's also written other books such as The Succulent Sex Craft and contributor of a book called Secrets of the Sex Masters. So we're just so excited. Sherry's been on such a journey and you're going to love hearing from her and learning from her. She's going to teach you more than you ever thought you didn't know about the woman's anatomy of arousal. So tune in, turn on, and fall in love with Sherry as much as we are. And we will see you on the other side.
Welcome to the Sex Reimagined podcast, where sex is shame-free and pleasure forward. Let's get into the show.
Welcome, Sherry.
Oh, well, it is my pleasure to be here talking to both of you and sharing this with you all and your audience. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. So, Sherry, how did you get into this work? As I recall, you were in the nursing field, you were a midwife. Is my memory correct in that that's kind of how you started out?
Yeah, so mostly I was a midwife. So I did become a nurse, but that's because in the United States, in order to become a midwife, you have to become a nurse. So basically, my first calling was to assist women in birth. And I was a childbirth educator. Well, first, I was a massage therapist before that and always an artist. Anyway, so I started going to births and, you know, it was amazing and ecstatic, and I was very called to do it. Like I said, in order to get legal, I had to go to nursing school, which actually included some really awful years of my life. I was an alien. I'm such an alien, right? Because I was this like home birth natural remedies person, and here I was in nursing school having arguments with my obstetrics professor about the safety of home birth. She hated me.
You were the black sheep.
Yeah.
I totally was. Anyway, so I graduated with my bachelor's in nursing and then worked for a few more years assisting home birth midwives and then went to midwifery school for another couple of years. Now, the thing is, and I was also teaching, so I was also a childbirth educator, and I was teaching women how to have awesome births. So I was learning and teaching how to do things like use your breathing, right? use your imagination, use your intention and your awareness and your sound and your pelvic floor muscles. And I started teaching that stuff when I was 20. Sometime around when I reached 30, I had this epiphany and I realized I had been training myself to have better sex. I didn't know it literally for 10 years, but I was using all of those skills, sound and pelvic floor muscles. And when when I was with a partner who started commenting on my abilities, I was kind of like, well, can't all women do that with their pussy muscles? And he's like, no. And I remember really being shocked because I just assumed, I didn't think I was doing anything special, but I actually was. And so once I realized I'd been unconsciously training myself, that's when I started studying sexuality, going to Tantra classes and Taoist, and studied with a Native American medicine priest and all of this natural stuff about sexuality and also Western sexological research. So I'm studying that at that point, really thinking it was so that I would have even better sex, because I figured, well, I went, you know, I got this far without even trying. Let's see where I can go if I try. But the funny thing was, well, not really funny, but the amazing thing was that the stuff I was learning in sex world, I was bringing back to birth world. Mm. So everything I was learning about sex was helping me be a better midwife and helping me help women birth more, you know, awesomely and ecstatically and primally. And that started me really understanding that birth and sex are not these separate things. That's what we're kind of taught, right? That, you know, sex gets the baby started and then has nothing to do with it. It's just not true. And the more I studied, I started realizing, oh, it's all integral, that we actually have a baby's bliss and bonding system. And the intelligence of this system, the brilliance of it is exquisite. And I just started seeing more and more ways that this was all connected. So when I was always teaching, and I've been teaching this information, I started understanding this anatomy in a different way and seeing things that were missing and finding pieces of the puzzle and putting that together. And so I was teaching, along with childbirth stuff, what I called womancraft classes, which were things like menstrual health and the female anatomy. I used to call it Maps of the Clitoris was the first name of that class, of women's anatomy of arousal. I was getting burnt out on the baby thing because I'd been on call for like 20 years.
It's hard to be on call like that. Yeah.
Yeah, at a certain point, I was kind of like, oh, I need a break. So I actually thought I was going to go back to midwifing. But I took a break and I was just working doing gynecology in a clinic and, you know, in prenatal care and well woman care, stuff like that. And I thought, oh, in 6 months or a year, I'll go back to midwifery. And meanwhile, I decided to add a class to my teaching about orgasm for women, female orgasm. And man, was that class fun to teach women about how to have orgasms and bigger, better, easier orgasms. And then my guy friends wanted to come to the class. And I'm like, no, you can't come. It's just for women. And they're like, oh, but we want to learn. We want our women to be happy. So like, all right, I'll teach a class for guys about female sexuality. And that was so much fun. I mean, right? like they're all sitting there listening to me.
Yeah, totally. With rapt attention, hanging on every word.
Exactly. And then I started teaching class for everyone about, you know, sexual communication. And that just kept blossoming and it just kept expanding. Every class I taught would lead to another class. So I started teaching classes about touch and how to be more adept at giving and receiving and yin and yang and all these other things. And so as that's expanding and time's going by, I'm realizing I have no desire to go back to catching babies. I'm done with the midwife thing. And my calling now is about helping people birth their sexuality.
Oh, love
and
that.
And that's how I became a sexuality teacher.
Yeah.
So beautiful. And too, I love how you bridge, you know, how the baby comes in is also how the baby comes out. I've done doula work too myself for years. And it's like when a woman can get into her animalistic, raw, primal state and really just like be in the sensation of it. That is, it just moves everything so much more effectively.
What's been your experience of this like orgasmic birth phenomenon that people are saying more and more about? What's the correlation between orgasmic birth, orgasm, painful birth, painful pregnancies, like this pain and pleasure place? Is there anything you can shine some light on regarding those two pieces?
I have a whole class and an intensive version of that class.
Oh, great.
Of course,
so
you
I can talk
it.
About it for about 6 hours, okay. But I'll
try. Tell us where to sign up for this class.
I actually have some recorded online classes, and this is one of them, a short one, a short version of that class. So it's called The Ecstatic Journey of Birth and Sex. Okay, so we're using the same equipment to have sex and to birth babies. It's the same altered state of consciousness. So arousal is an altered state of consciousness. And labor is an altered state of consciousness. And they are influenced by the biochemical soup that we create and that we swim in. And we have the ability to enhance our trance, right? I can't make myself go into a trance, but I can do things to facilitate it happening.
Love it.
I can create an environment where it's more likely to happen. I can create a mindset where it's more likely to happen. And so all of those things, again, can be used in sex and in birth. In fact, before I had heard of orgasmic birth, I had attended a few births. These were all home births, by the way. This is highly unlikely to happen in a hospital birth. But I was doing home birth at that point, and I attended some home births where the women, to me, appeared to be having an orgasmic, ecstatic labor. And of course, I wasn't going to ask them about it while it was going on because I don't want to mess it up. Last thing you want to do is stimulate the thinking at either in labor or sex, right? But afterwards, I talked to them about it, and they reported, I had about, I guess, three of them. One woman said, I was just having orgasms. And the other women described it as being in the state of ecstasy. And I asked them, does it feel like kind of like orgasmic? And they're like, yeah, like these orgasmic waves. So I was intrigued, to say the least, right? And then talking to other midwives and at conferences. And then I ran into a woman who I had been in a study group with this wonderful midwife way, way back in my early 20s, learned so much from her. And she was really interested. And she wound up going on to write a book and do a video called Orgasmic Birth. Deborah something. Last Betts? Name is escaping me.
Is it Deborah Betts? Mm-mm.
No, it's a multi-syllable name. Anyway, Orgasmic Birth. If you look up the book in the video, you will find her. Yeah. What can we do to maximize the chances that women will have that kind of a birth? And again, just like the same thing, enhance the trance, create the set and setting. There's no guarantee. However, if we create that kind of internal and external environment, even if women don't experience their labor as ecstatic or orgasmic, they can have what I call a primal labor. And a primal labor means your brain is not, and their thinking brain is offline. It is out of the way. And your body and the process of labor itself is making things happen. So I would give an example. Sometimes women, you know, sometimes the baby's not in exactly the best ideal position. And I could feel that and I could tell women, let's get you in this position like lie on your side with your knee up and your other leg, and let's roll this way and we'll do this. And I had all these little tricks I could do to help them help the baby reposition. When a woman is having a primal birth, I don't need to do that. She just gets in those positions. Oh. No one is telling her what to do. She just, her body and the magic and the miracle of the intelligence of nature is just, she's in that position. She's on her hands and knees. She's rocking her belly, and the baby will just shift without me telling her.
Oh, I love that. The attunement.
The attunement. And primal births usually go fast.
Yeah, it's like the Shakti comes in, that sexual energy of the feminine essence of life just comes in and takes over. It's, I call it the yin field, what you're talking about, the trance space, you know, it's just really inviting in. And like you said, you can't make it happen. You just create the environment, and then it just usually takes its own course.
Yeah. And essentially labor is actually this wonderful yin yang experience, because that first part of labor is all about surrendering, releasing and opening. And then the second part where we have to push the baby out, that's the yang part of labor. And that's when we're like in our animal power.
Yeah.
And there's nothing more powerful than a woman pushing a baby out, right? And so we need both. And sometimes some women need more of one or the other. Like some women are like way too in control and they can't do that yin surrender. But then if you get them to the pushing part, they're great. Mm-hmm. Other women are okay with the surrender, however they get to the pushing and they're like, oh wow, that's too intense. I can't do that.
I want to back up. Yeah. Right? I changed my mind.
Yeah, well, in labor, all women change their mind.
Yeah, right at the
it's
ring
a
of
phase
fire.
Of labor. I call it the I can't do this phase of labor.
Then
in fact,
you know
women
close.
Start saying that, yeah. That's like great. Well, you're saying that. That means you're almost there.
You're almost wow. there.
Yeah.
Is that where a woman starts to use meditation and hypnotherapy to help create before the birth process, to prepare the mind so it knows the where to follow, where to take the mind?
Exactly.
Is that a part of the training leading up to birth?
It can be, and ideally it will be. Because keep in mind, we have been inundated our entire lives with horrible images of birth. Mm-hmm. Terrible birth stories. You know, every birth you see on TV or in a movie, they're screaming hysterically. They need to be rescued. They almost die. The baby almost dies. The doctor swoops in and rescues them. Or it's the comedy version where, you know, everybody panics and the husband, you know, forgets to put the wife in the car, you know, whatever.
Right.
They're just these ridiculous stories, but they're always horrible until the woman gets the anesthesia and then she's just, oh, so happy. She's been rescued. So we need to reprogram our brains about birth. And what I used to do was have women read good birth stories. Like Ina May Gaskin's classic book I read when I was 13, Spiritual Midwifery, filled with these wonderful birth stories.
Great one.
Then we started having videos. Right? Videotapes. Remember the cassette tapes?
Yeah.
If you're old enough, you remember. And then I had a lending library that I could give women to take home so they could watch and see images. And then of course, when Deborah Pascali Bonaro.
There you go. That's her name.
It's in there. Mm-hmm. And when she made that video, any woman who's thinking about ever having a baby or is pregnant should watch the orgasmic birth video, because when you see women doing it, it's a visceral, you are in sympathetic relationship. And so you better understand what's going on and what you could do to get to that same place.
Yeah, those mirror neurons from watching the video can help your body learn what the body needs. Sometimes it's not this mental thing. It's really a visual thing. If you want what somebody else has, get your body next to their body. And
that's
say,
right.
Body, learn.
Yeah.
Learn. Pick that up.
Absolutely.
Yeah. If you're ever lucky enough to attend a home birth and be in the presence of a woman who does that, that's how women would learn in the past, right?
Right.
We would go assist other women with births. It was how we learned. You know, the same with breastfeeding. You know, I've had women who primarily lived in other countries and were more in a more primal culture, you know, not a first
tribal.
World culture. And those women never had a problem breastfeeding. Never, ever. because they grew up around it. They instantly held their baby and nursed their baby in exactly the way that worked. And then we have women who've grown up in our first world culture where breastfeeding is not normal and we don't see it and they don't know what to do and it gets messed up. And so again, you know, we're sort of designed to have learned these things.
Yeah, it should be passed on. Yeah.
Unfortunately, most of us don't.
Yeah, it's amazing that there were generations where women were discouraged from breastfeeding. My mom didn't get breastfed. Matt, my husband, didn't get breastfed. His father never got breastfed. There's this generational gap around breastfeeding that's kind of interesting. And as we make a correlation between like breastfeeding and the orgasmic experience, I've not gone through the baby making process. But in many of my classes, women who've experienced Amrita, the female ejaculation, one of the ways that they describe how it feels in their vulva when they start to feel the descension of the ejaculation is when they've nursed and they felt the letting down of the milk in their breast. What can you say about that, Sherry?
Well, that's how I figured out the mechanism.
Okay.
So first of all, I will say I did, I do have a son and I did breastfeed him and it was an utterly ecstatic experience. Mm. So breastfeeding is another part of the baby's bliss and bonding system. That ecstasy bonds us to our babies. It helps us tolerate them because, oh my gosh, they're just a crazy amount of work, right? So we're supposed to fall madly in love with them. This is the oxytocin, which is the bonding hormone, but also the hormones of limerence, which is the falling in love hormones.
Limerence.
The falling in love hormones. So I would say the best falling in love I've ever had in my life was with my baby.
Oh, yeah, I think that's so beautiful. And a lot
of that's
mothers who get to experience that are so blessed and so lucky.
Well, you know, it gets messed up again. If we understood that that's what's supposed to happen and we did everything in our power to enhance that, we'd have more mothers falling in love with their babies and more mothers breastfeeding successfully. Yeah. And we're doing better than we were back when I was born and you all were born, but we're still not doing that great. We've stalled. We still have a lot of women who don't try to breastfeed, don't want to breastfeed. And we have a lot of women who think they have failed at breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. And what they have, unfortunately, has happened is our culture has failed them. They didn't have the information and support they needed to understand how breastfeeding works and how to enhance that. And they didn't have the help or the support they might've needed if there was a true problem, which is not that common, right? Some babies like are tongue tied, their tongue, the little
thing
under the tongue, the frenulum under the tongue is too tight. They can't nurse properly, right? That, if that's identified early and taken care of, everything's fine.
Yeah.
Most women are not succeeding at breastfeeding because they've gotten the wrong information. They don't understand. If you give the baby a pacifier or a bottle, they're going to suck wrong on your nipple. Oh. Right. And then the whole system's going to fall apart. Right. Yeah. So we're failing women in that sense. There was somewhere we were going.
Yeah. Female ejaculation.
Female ejaculation. Yes. Okay. So female ejaculation. So let's go back before anybody had ever heard of female ejaculation. Right. And I was, take us back. So I first heard about it, about Annie Sprinkle, mm-hmm. who is a feminist porn heroine, right? And she was ejaculating. And I remember thinking, yeah, right. It's just pee. This is bullshit, right? Oh. Okay. So I didn't believe it. But in my practice, I would meet women who would tell me that they had this experience of liquid gushing out. And at first I used to say, oh, you're just juicier than other women, just enjoy it, there's nothing wrong with you. I had women who were treated for urinary incontinence, by the way, including and up to surgery to fix the problem.
Jeez. I've heard of that, yeah.
So at that certain point, I started wondering, well, maybe it is real for some small number of women. Then I was lucky enough to meet a woman and have a brief affair with her, and she was an ejaculator. And the first time we were going to bed, she said, oh, I need some towels. I get some little towels. And she's like, no, I need big towels. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, okay. So I got to see it up close and personal. Coming out on the white towels. Doesn't smell like urine. It's not yellow. I'm like, okay, this is real. You are one of the lucky women who can do this thing. But I hadn't experienced it and I didn't think I could. But at that point, I was really going deep into the sex world, so learning about sexuality. And I started meeting women who were started telling me, oh, I learned how to ejaculate. I didn't used to ejaculate and now I do. And as soon as I heard that, I was like, oh, well, I've learned all this other stuff.
Yeah, it's teachable.
I've learned how to have orgasms and how to have orgasms in all different ways and how to have lots of them and mega orgasms. It's like, well, if I learned all that, I can learn this. Now, there was no information. There were no videos. I mean, there was nothing. So I think it probably was over about maybe a year or two, a couple of years. And I started experiencing it. First only with like a marathon sex date where you just were at it for hours, you know, doing all the different things and eventually just gushing. And I remember the first time it happened, I was like, whoa, that's it.
Get a load of this. Oh my God.
And that speaks to too, also like creating the environment. You know, if it's something your body's never done before, you want to create the environment for that yin to flow through.
Absolutely. So then it got to the point where I was able to happen more often. That started, I was able to do it. Then it was happening all the time. At a certain point, I was like, wait, sometimes I need to turn this off, right? Then I had to learn, like if you're in somebody's car or something.
Right.
Where you're like...
the environment is not prepared for
it. Yeah, exactly. Anyways, I kind of learned to try it. Meanwhile, out in the world, I'm like trying to research this and figure out what's happening. Now, in the world of Tantra, as I'm sure you know, people would be like, oh, it's a gift of the goddess. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, sure it is. But where does it come from? That doesn't help me in terms of the physiology and the anatomy. I want to know what this mechanism is, especially because most doctors and medical people and even sex teachers and so forth are saying it's not real. It doesn't exist. So I knew it had to do with the urethral sponge, which is the erectile tissue that surrounds the urethra, that tube of erectile tissue. I was aware of the glandular structures that were within it at that point. And then I'm tuning in as I'm getting ready to ejaculate. And all of a sudden I'm like, oh my gosh, it feels just like letdown. So when you're breastfeeding, you get this like microscopic tingling inside your breasts just before you have big gushes. And all of a sudden I was like, boom, how do we make breast milk? We've got glandular tubules with a single cell wall surrounded by capillaries with a single cell wall. The watery part of our blood can diffuse through a single cell membrane. So the water from our blood goes through the capillary wall, through the wall of the tubules, mixes with the substance that those cells produce. This is what makes it a gland. It produces a protein or different kinds of proteins. In this case, in breast milk, the breast milk proteins. And out it comes. That's breast milk. How much breast milk can a woman make? As much as she needs. As long as you continue to stimulate mechanical stimulation of the areola, and hydrates, you can make all the breast milk you need. You have two babies, you have two babies sucking twice the mechanical stimulation, you can make twice the milk. This is another reason why women so-called fail at breastfeeding, because people don't understand this supply and demand. Like, we make milk as long as the baby's sucking. If the baby's sucking in a pacifier, we're not getting the stimulation. We're not going to make as much milk.
Well, something so fascinating, my best friend's here in Sacramento, a married couple, both women are nursing the baby. And it's from, you know, one of them had to go and learn the whole nipple stimulation. And it's been this incredible experience for them both to feed the baby.
Awesome.
It is like, great. Oh my God.
Such and good bonding.
You can be menopause could have come and gone and you can still nurse. And
yeah,
male partners can nurse. And yeah, this is
a little bit
widely unknown. Tiny a little bit. Yeah. Okay.
A little bit. Well, but, I just but think in traditional special cultures, again, if a mama died, grandma would pick up that baby and start at nursing. Mm-hmm. Right? That was a survival thing. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's pretty amazing. Right. Anyway, so once I connected that up with, then I was like, oh, I get it. I know how we make Amrita. We make it because we've got glandular tubules in that tube of erectile tissue surrounded by capillaries, the erectile capillaries. The watery part of the blood diffuses across the membrane, mixes with the proteins the cells make, and those glandular tubules empty into the urethra. And then it can squirt out the pee hole. Or we could hold it in and it'll back up into the bladder and just come out the next time we
piss it out. Yeah.
And so now I believe all women, if you have any amount of arousal, I believe you are making at least some small amount of that fluid. With the appropriate stimulation of that tissue, with lots more engorgement of those erectile capillaries, then you'll make a lot of fluid. Mm-hmm. Right? So I think all women, we're all ejaculating, just a lot of women aren't getting that kind of stimulation that they need. They're not having a deep arousal and massive orgasms. So they're not getting the huge gush, but you could.
Yeah. And also Amrita could come as a flood. It could come as a gush. It could come as a squirt. It could come in all, you know, can come in.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So what do you have to say about the reports that the female G-spot is actually the female prostate gland as compared to the urethral sponge?
Okay, so the female is the default setting. As embryos, we basically start out with female equipment. And if that body is going to become a penis owner, they get flooded with those male hormones and things change. So it would be more appropriate to say that the prostate is actually the male urethral sponge.
Okay.
Like it would be, that would be actually more anatomically and embryologically accurate. So the prostate gland is a glandular and erectile structure, just like the urethral sponge.
Okay.
What people are calling the G-spot is just the bottom of that sponge. Okay. It's not a separate structure. So when somebody says the G-spot, they're just talking about the part of this urethral sponge that you can reach from inside when you're rubbing up against the roof of the vagina. Okay. And that is the bottom of that cylinder of erectile tissue that contains those glands. But like I said, it would be more appropriate to name the male body part after the female body, because that's how we all started. Also, I'm just so sick of our body parts being named after men.
Like,
and also sometimes inappropriately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Because, for example, our uterus moves during arousal. It also moves during the fertility cycle. And it's one of our ways of gauging where we are in our cycle. But during arousal, it gets pulled up and forward. And then during orgasm, it bounces up and down. And it does that because there are two structures that are called the round ligaments. And in male bodies, they are ligaments, not female bodies. In female bodies, it's a muscle, like a rope, surrounded by a fibrous sheath. And they start on top of the uterus, they go over the pubic bone, and the other end attaches to the muscle that goes around the vaginal opening. So just these other interesting connections. And that's what moves the uterus. So okay, they're called round ligaments, which is completely incorrect. They're muscles with a fibrous sheath. So why are they named round ligaments? Because that's what they are in male bodies.
What should we name them?
Yeah, what are we going to call them?
The round uterine muscles.
Round uterine muscles, everybody.
Yeah.
Got that? Good.
And so that's
anatomy class. So fun.
I know. So sexy. So that's what moves the uterus up and down, not only during your entire monthly fertile cycle, but also when you are aroused and when you're having an orgasm. Now, tell us a little bit, like, why does the cervix go up and down during orgasm? There's something about fertility there, right?
There is. You are so right. So here's the thing. Mother Nature wants us to make babies, right? This is the template, whether we want them or not.
Right,
right. The fundamental template is going to always be about reproduction. And so in order to maximize the chances of getting pregnant, we've got this brilliant system in place. So in the ideal fertility scenario, you would have a vagina owner and a penis owner, and they would be having intercourse. The vagina owner would be in a high state of arousal, so her uterus is picked up out of the back of the vagina, so that penis is not hitting it, because that wouldn't like that. Okay, yeah. So she's nicely aroused. The penis is going in and out. There's this beautiful bowl right there at the back of the vagina. Ejaculation happens. And then again, ideal fertility scenario, the woman has a rip-roaring orgasm, and her uterus, now remember, there's this bowl in the back of the vagina, and now her uterus is going to go and suck up as much semen as possible. Because here's the thing, semen is delicate, fragile. And it cannot live very long in the vagina. The vagina is very acidic, and it's a hostile environment for sperm. They're not going to live long in the vagina. But during the fertile time of a woman's cycle, so for about 5 days of her cycle, her cervix is open more, and the glands inside the cervix are producing what I call fertile flow, and it's traditionally called fertile mucus. No. Doesn't sound nice. Fertile flow. And so what happens when that fertile flow is coming is that slimy, slippery substance acts like a slip and slide. It literally forms channels that the sperm can just go zoom, zoom, zoom into the cervix. Whoa. The more sperm you get in, the better the chance of making a baby. Not only do they go into the cervix, but inside the cervix are these little pockets, and they are called cervical crypts. But a crypt is a place you go to die. So I call them the sperm hotels.
Much, much more appropriate.
Because the sperm can check in and hang out in the sperm hotels for up to 5 days. The egg is only good for a day. You've got maybe 24 hours of a good egg, but now you've got 5 days of sperm going after the egg, right? So what if the sperm's there a day or two early? No problem, right?
Right. And go hang out by the pool. Enjoy your stay.
Exactly. They get room service. We nourish them. We feed them. And so... that
definitely
movement, right? But that movement, because also what you've got, partly because of the shape of the head of the penis, is you've created a bit of a vacuum inside the vagina. It's like a little negative pressure. And so when that uterus dips into the pool, it's actually literally upsucking semen, as well as having it slide up the slipping sides. Mm. So again,
pretty amazing.
So, amazing.
Well, I find this so sexy. I wonder if
our bodies are just incredible.
Yeah, like I think once your
it is
mind
sexy.
Kind of like opens up to the amazing world of sexuality, when you stop having that sort of visceral reaction around shame and fear and dirtiness and some of that stuff that many of us have been groomed from a young age to feel about sex, once that dissolves, conversations like this and learning about how miraculous this whole mystical, yet more and more understandable system, it's you get to keep the magic even as you start to learn the truth of like what's really happening. It is sexy. It is,
right.
I feel turned on by like, wow, get a load of me, you know?
Yeah.
I'm probably not going to ever have a kid, but I sure like that I was born to do all this crazy cool shit.
Yeah, that your body is capable of that. So I've always been curious, Sherry, I wonder if you know, is it true that you can kind of, you're more likely to have a female child post peak ovulation moment because the swimmers are the female swimmers are stronger swimmers? Is that true?
Yeah, it is. Now it's just a little shift of the statistics, so it's not going to be dramatic.
It's not for sure.
But female sperm are hardier than male sperm. So if you're ovulating and you have sex right when you're ovulating, it's probably going to be about 50-50.
Right.
But you know, if it's you're having sex and you're ovulating a few days later, it's slightly more likely. But here's, this is so cool. You'll love this. Do you know there's three kinds of sperm?
There's a third?
Yay. There's three kinds of sperm. So there's the athletes, right? And their job is to zip up and try and get there and fertilize the egg. There are also blockers. And their job is to hang out in the cervix and in that fertile mucus and keep any other sperm out.
Like goalies.
Exactly, right?
So, and is so it looking out for its
for other resume, guys?
Or for other guys?
No,
okay.
Other guys' sperm.
Yeah. Other sperm from
and
other
then
bodies.
There are fighter sperm, and they're like little Pac-Man, and they eat and attack other men's sperm.
Dang. Wow.
Yeah,
nature.
I know.
Come on now.
Whose sperm is the mightiest?
Well, you know, there is survival of the fittest at a lot of different levels here.
Yeah.
So that's another level.
That's really
neat. So if women are maximizing their chances of not only making a baby, but making the best baby.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
So maybe you have a couple different sperm donors. It's so interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
So would that also mean that if a woman has, you know, a number of different lovers and either wants to get pregnant or doesn't know about wanting or not wanting?
Yeah.
And, well, what was my question?
Is she more likely to get pregnant with
her
lover?
Is she more likely to get pregnant than another woman who has one lover? Yeah, that was it.
Well, first of all, a woman is more likely to be having better sex with a lover than her long-term partner because it's new and exciting.
Right.
Yeah.
Probably having better orgasms. That's going to increase the chance of fertility. So if a woman has got a husband who we'll call him a husband, a husband who she's been with for a long time and isn't having great sex with, and she's got a lover on the side, that her husband doesn't know about, she is more likely to be fertile and get pregnant and impregnated by the lover. Now, is she having more sex with the lover? Maybe. That could be part of it. But there's also really interesting things. Now, the husband is going to make a higher percentage of fighter and blocker sperm if he suspects she's having an affair.
Okay.
Wow.
Also, there's something about proximity. So if I'm with my guy all the time, he's going to make hardly any fighter sperm. The more I'm away and out of his sight, the higher percentage of fighter sperm he's going to make. Now, the study I'd like to see, which nobody has done, is, well, what if you've got a couple of lovers and you're polyamorous and everybody's cool with it, right?
Right.
So he's not jealous. He's fine with it, right? So, but nobody's done those kinds of studies.
Well, what about dreams? Because I had a dream last night of having sex with Brad Pitt and Robert De Niro.
Oh my God. What
it was
dream.
Such a good night's sleep. Let me tell you, it was heightened. I was going to be murdered too. So it was like really off the chart. Yeah, it was life threatening. And I was just coming over and over and over again. I'd like to know the test. Is my husband going to create some more fighter sperm?
Blockers.
Because of these hot dreams I'm having.
I don't think so.
No.
Because think about the pheromones. He's not going to be feeling jealous. He's not going to be feeling jealous. If you tell him about it, he might be. Yeah.
I did, and he really wasn't jealous. He was more celebratory. Yeah.
Exactly. So that's why I think if you're poly, that thing with the fighter sperm increasing wouldn't happen. So I think it's a function of jealousy.
Interesting.
Interesting.
But very, that, who knows? Yeah. That's just a theory.
It's amazing.
So fun. Right? So fun. Much fun. Yeah.
So, God, Sherry, you are just a wealth of information, and we could talk to you and wrap up for hours and hours and hours because there's just so much good stuff to go into here. I just want to maybe get one more little snippet from you because your knowledge is so vast. You know, what is one of the key things that you would want to share with women about their anatomy in order to, for them to understand how to create more pleasure?
Yeah. If I can just rephrase it slightly if you could only teach one thing that could make an impact in a woman's, like everything else, we're like, you're censored. What's the one thing that would be so important that your message could share?
So women have what I call the female erectile network, which is a network of structures that are all made out of erectile tissue. Mm-hmm. Erectile tissue is what penises are made out of. So we already know what erectile tissue can do. It can go from small and soft to big and hard. When it fills up with blood, that gets trapped. That's called engorgement. Women have just as much erectile tissue as a penis owner does. Pound for pound, inch for inch, but it's arranged differently. And so in some ways it acts the same, and in other ways it does not. So we've got a network of structures. So one way that it's different is that we can get aroused and orgasmic with just one little part of the network activated, right? So if all we know is the head of the clitoris as the good spot, and we play with the head of the clitoris and we get turned on and we have an orgasm, yay, that's great. That's a fine, fine thing. I'm not knocking it. But it's like trying to play the piano when you think you've only got 12 keys. No, you've got 88 keys and foot pedals. So when you learn about all of the erectile structures and you stimulate all of the structures, that amplifies your arousal and orgasmic capacity in a quantum way. You get these circuits of interconnected, overlapping erogenous activity, because it's not just the erectile tissue, it's the nerve pathways, which you have multiple pathways of as well. So if you really want to learn how to have the most absolutely mind-boggling arousal and orgasms, then learn what you've got, learn how to make it happy, and get everybody in the band playing along, because it's pretty dramatic, the difference. And you know, when I was young, back in the BC before computers, back in the old days, we didn't know anything. We didn't have any information, basically. I still remember getting a hold of The Joy of Sex. First copy of Joy of Sex does not mention the word clitoris at all.
Crazy.
Right. Then I got a hold of Our Bodies, Ourselves. I was about 12 or 13. And that's where I was found. I was like, oh, that, yeah, that's what it's called. Because I had discovered it. I didn't know its name. It's like, oh, okay, that's what it's called. But none of the rest of the erectile network are in those books. Still not. So, but I was able to have some great orgasms, mostly by myself. And then eventually I learned how to have orgasms with partners and how to communicate. And then it got easier to have them. And I learned how to have more of them. And I didn't have orgasms with intercourse when I started, like most women don't. And I learned how to do that. And so I learned all this stuff. But once I got that map of all the parts, it was like the difference between singing a song and playing the guitar and having a full orchestra. Yeah. Right? I mean, you just can't compare them. They're both wonderful. But if you want to have the orchestral orgasms, you got to play the whole instrument. And I don't even just mean the genital part. I mean
the whole instrument.
This part. Yeah, this part.
From head to toe.
This part. Yeah. Everything. So that's the most important thing, I think.
Oh, I love that. That's amazing. And that's why your book is so valuable. Yeah. And again, like if you have not gotten Women's Anatomy of Arousal, you must. It's a must.
You know, I have to just say that I have a very distinct before and after experience of myself and my own body, Sherry, from before I did Sherry's work, well into a sex expert career to after Sherry's teachings. And this body really up-leveled the refinement, the distinctions, the subtlety. I had a big growth spurt in my own experience of my own pleasure, of my own communication ability, and my understanding of how my sexual body can expand due to this understanding of this is how my sexual self can fully come online, like up-level on turn-on big time. So I encourage everyone to seek out Sherry. And she's just, as you can see, you've only had an hour.
I know. And so much we got out of her in 1 hour.
Get yourself lots of hours with Sherry.
Lots of hours.
Well, like I said, I do have some recorded online courses and classes.
Yeah.
Which is a way to really get the information, because it's not just me talking, but I'm also an artist. I've done my own anatomy illustrations. I use lots of visuals. So there's lots of different ways to learn, because some people learn better by seeing than hearing.
We have you've generously given us a free gift for our viewers. Could you say a little bit about Hergasmic Abundance online class?
Yeah. So it's an online class that's focused on female orgasm. Although I must say, pretty much most of the stuff that's in it would apply to most people with whatever kind of body you have, whatever sort of plumbing you have. But it is focused on female orgasm, because we have a huge orgasm gap. And that's just unacceptable. It's worse than the wage gap.
We need to bridge that gap.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. We have a lot of women who are not having orgasms, who have not yet learned how to have an orgasm at all, or have them sometimes, but they're not assured. And I do always want to say to women, there's nothing wrong with you. You are not broken. It's just stuff you haven't learned yet. It's like playing the piano. If you haven't learned how to play the piano, you don't feel ashamed, but you can learn if you want. Yeah. So this is about how to learn to play your own instrument and become a virtuoso of your own erotic abilities, capacities, equipment, the whole nine yards.
Oh, I love that. It's going to be such an incredible gift. Thank you so much for offering that to all of our participants. Make sure that you grab that gift and tune in more to Sherry and her work, because it is vast and profound and really changing the face of what we know sexuality to be.
Yeah. Thank you, Sherry.
Yeah. Sherry,
it's my pleasure.
Yeah, baby.
Ours too.
Exactly. It's all our pleasure.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for the work you're doing and getting the information from me and all these other wonderful speakers out to people, because you are both so wise and have so much to share yourselves. So I'm just grateful that you're doing this and helping get the culture shifted into a more sex positive, living life, ecstatic, positive world.
Yes. Yeah, an alive, awakened world. That's what we're going for here.
Yay.
All right. Thank you so much, Sherry.
Okay.
And we'll see all of you for the next interview.
Now, our favorite part, the dish.
Well, here we are again, post interview with the great Sherry Winston.
Oh, I just love Sherry.
I love Sherry. God, is she a wealth of information and knowledge and wisdom and expertise.
Oh my gosh, she's such a great teacher. She just feels so user friendly. I feel like she's just such a mama of wisdom, you know.
She's so yummy, and I was with her again, I forgot just how much I have integrated her teachings. Like some of the things I say on a regular basis now as a part of what I teach, I forgot that it was a lot of stuff came from her, you know, like she's Absolutely. Been a huge influence in how I share so much of what I've learned in my own body. So thank you, Sherry.
Yeah. And it surprises me actually how many women have not heard of her book before. I mean, very conscious women have really never heard of what Sherry's up to or her work or what she's doing. So you'll hear me tout her book over and over again, Woman's Anatomy of Arousal. Go get it. If you have not read it, get it now. Women's Anatomy of Arousal.
She's the top three books I recommend to students for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Her book is like homework assignment.
Yeah. Maybe, you know, I have a suggested reading list. So at some point we will get that on the website as a little download for y'all.
That sounds fun. She really highlights like the importance of how we use our sexuality, not just in sex, but in everything that we do physically. I really like that part of it because we can go into like mentally and spiritually pretty easily, but really how we use our sexuality to give birth, how we can use our sexuality to move physically through these bodies and these lives that we're in. So it's really fun to listen to her.
You know what I didn't realize? She might have taught me this before in the past, but what I do remember is oftentimes I will have, if someone penetrates me before I'm really, really ready, it can hurt, right? Mm-hmm. Like something bumps up against my cervix, it's uncomfortable. And once she gave me that insight, this whole idea of premature penetration and how we're all guilty of it, it's like for some reason there's this urgency to get it up, get it in, and get it off. In sex, and I don't know if it's our illusion because we think we don't have enough time for everything in our day or what propels us to like rush into penetrative sex. But it really made sense to me when she first taught me that in order for that to dissipate, in order for us to be able to really want it deep. You know those times when like you just want to grab their ass and you want to get them all the way in you, like those times when you are so open and you are so deep. It's like you just want to, your pussy just wants to gobble it all up. I love those. I love those hot turned on moments. And the reason why we feel that way is because we're turned on enough that the cervix actually pulls up and makes more space so that we can take something more fully in, deeper in. And I love that. And I always tell our students at our workshops, look, you got to be aware that if you spend more time on the turn on phase, there isn't going to be that flinch back because it hurts when someone penetrates you. You're going to want to grab their ass and take them all the way in. And everyone should want that. But what I didn't realize, like the next layer that Sherry really brought to the table for me in the interview was that like this whole connection between that there's this well in the back of the yoni where the sperm can kind of pool, and then when the cervix dips in and then contracts up and dips in and contracts up, how it's like a sucker that brings the sperm into the cervix, that whole part around fertility. Wow, did that go ding ding ding? That is so effing cool.
Yeah,
I mean, our bodies are so cool.
Yeah, if you didn't think your body was a miracle already, you are definitely going to after you hear Sherry describe these what are called round ligaments, but she has renamed them to a much more appropriate name. And you know, she's just so wise. I was thinking, you know, because the way that I train sexologists to be sexologists is to be the ologist, the study of, or the observator of your own sexual energy. She's such a true sexologist. I mean, she figured out literally through her body, through her experience, through what she knows about midwifery. Yeah. Through what she knows about letdown in the breasts, you know, when you're breastfeeding, you get that sensation of letdown. And she figured out through that part of her anatomy, what Amrita actually is. I mean, it's just so brilliant. So
yeah. wasn't her story cool about Amrita and her suspicion and her doubt, and then seeing it for the first time and then experiencing it for the first time, and how all of that started to really lift and change. I love that she gave us her journey into the whole female ejaculation process.
Yeah, it was so great.
And then the other thing was really cool, like, again, coming back to like psycholinguistics of language, and are talking about these pockets within the uterine wall that they call crypts, which is like, it should be called a spa hotel. I mean, not crypts, where like the sperm get to like hang out for 5 days in the atmosphere in order to capitalize on the ovulating moment to increase the ability to get pregnant. That it's not a crypt. They're not going there to like die. They're going there to really survive. It's the opposite. You know, I thought that was so cool.
Yeah, it's so fascinating when a woman gets into anatomy, because anatomy was developed by the male brain. You know, it was like the scientists and the doctors of old were always men, and they were the ones who got to name everything and coin everything and like phrase everything. It's just sometimes the words that we use for structures in the body are either negative or completely nonsensical, or like you just said, the complete opposite of what they actually do.
I also loved how this correlation between sperm and its fight. It's like if you're in a long-term relationship, right? How the sperm react compared to if the partner might be cheating, and how the sperm revive themselves in order to be the fittest. And I just thought, wow, that's so interesting, because long-term sex, a common complaint, a long-term sex, long-term relationship, might as well call it long-term sex. It can be routine and it can get a little boring. I think that's the big struggle for long-term relationships, is how to keep sex interesting and engaging. And there is something to be said about, why is having an affair so compelling? You know, what is like that biological impulse that, you know, helps us feel alive? Which is just kind of just a sideline, but I just want to like bring it in for a minute. I really love what Esther Perel says about this whole idea of affairs, that the reason why infidelity is compelling is because it brings us into relationship with something that we thought that we lost within ourselves. Mm-hmm. In long-term relationship, there are certain parts of ourself that kind of go to the wayside, that part that gets really exciting and it's turned on, and the novelty of something, that freedom of something, the whatever those parts are that get sort of covered up. When you have an affair, you get to be in relationship with that part of yourself that you thought was missing. And so I think it'd be fun to talk further in another episode about, how can we do that without infidelity? How can we re-engage those parts of ourselves without having to go through the painful betrayal, rejective experience, and chaotic, drama-filled stuff that infidelity brings? How can we have an affair with our partner?
Role play, baby. Role play. Yes. Among many other things. Yes, let's bookmark that for sure.
Yes, we get to learn right along with you. So I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we did. And love, love, love to Sherry.
Yeah, and let us know what you got out of it, what it brought to your life. Send us a message inside of the Instagram account, Sex Reimagined. We'd love to hear from you there.
Yeah, please do. And we will have Sherry on again. So one of the things that we do with your comments with a sex expert is, if we hear enough from y'all and you've got some great questions, boy, will that get us to get them back on the show as soon as possible, because this is your show. Well, we want to have things on here that spark and inspire you.
And maybe even do some co-teaching with them, so we can invite that forward too.
All right, y'all. Have a beautiful day. Love, love, love.
Thanks for tuning in. If the hosts seem to know what they were talking about, that's because they do. Leah Piper is a tantric sex master coach and a positive psychology facilitator. Dr. Willow Brown is both a Chinese and functional medicine doctor and a Taoist sexology teacher. Don't forget, your comments, likes, subscribes, and suggestions matter. Let's realize this new world together.
Awaken Arousal Oil is my new best friend. Like Laura says, holy forking shirt balls, did it deliver on its promise. I could feel the blood flow and warmth, and that was the easiest I've ever achieved multiple orgasms. This is all natural botanical oils. It is made with CBD because CBD helps relax muscles and it eases tension. This stuff smells so good and it mixes with your pheromones like, mwah, so good. Get yourself some. Link is in the show notes.